Hi there, you've downloaded the podcast of Health Check from the BBC. Today we're putting some doctors to the test. Can they explain a medical condition without using any jargon at all? And the best bit is, I get to be quizmaster. Here's the show. Hello, welcome to Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond, and today we have the prisoners in Nairobi trying out mindfulness.
A life sentence, that is a negative one. But if I'm thinking positively, there's life after this, because there are people who have been here serving a life sentence, and they have, none of them has died here.
From Israel, the scientists sniffing out polio in sewage. And why are firefighters more likely than other people to have a heart attack? And family doctor Graham Easton is my guest today. Now, Graham, we are starting with the jargon that doctors use. And you must admit, mustn't you, it is quite common for doctors to use phrases that the rest of us as patients don't necessarily understand.
It is, sadly, and it's a very important issue that we do a lot of work on, because they say learning medicine can be a bit like learning a whole new language, like Russian, the number of new words. So what we then have to teach students is to unlearn them and translate them back into normal English.
After all that work learning them as well.
Yeah.
Well, help could be at hand for doctors in the form of a new board game called Doctor Jargon, created by a junior doctor from Inverness in Scotland called Victoria Roddleson. Now, in a moment, I'm going to put you and a couple of your medical students to the test. But before that, Victoria told me where she got the idea.
It started when I was a medical student, and we had to do a project on teaching. And one of my interests at the time was paediatrics, so working with children. And one of the key things for me was being in hospital as a child, it can be quite a stressful thing. And I thought one of the key things to focus on is how we communicate with children and how can we make that a little easier so that their time in hospital isn't so stressful.
So were you thinking that one of the problems was the particular words that the staff were using?
Yes, the use of jargon in particular. Whilst healthcare professionals all try their best to avoid using jargon, there's a lot of words that we just get used to using as a team between each other. And sometimes it can be difficult not to use those with children. So I really wanted to focus on making sure that the professionals really reflected on every word they were choosing with these children.
So had you noticed that yourself, that it was easy to use a word, I don't know, like inflammation or something like that, and assume that the child will know what inflamed means, when, of course, why should they know what that means?
Oh, definitely, yes. It does come up quite a lot on the wards. However hard you try, sometimes you'll be reviewing a child with any member of the team, and that team member might use that word, and then they'll finish the consultation and the parent or the child will say, well, what does that mean?
And then there was one little girl you met that solidified this for you.
Yes, I interviewed a few of the children and I got a really interesting comment from a little girl. She said that when doctors and nurses use words that she didn't understand, long words, that she often worried that it meant that there was something more serious wrong with her. So it made her worry.
And so if it had been explained to her, then she might have worried less. So she thought,
yes,
something was really wrong with her.
She did. And as soon as we explained to her that there wasn't something serious wrong with her, she said she could focus on getting better.
And so in the game, there are 160 different cards, and they cover a whole, all sorts of things, don't they? Like treatments and different diseases, all sorts of words that people might come across.
Yes. So this version of the game, so our game's called Doctor Jargon. This is the first in what we hope will be a series. And this one focuses on paediatrics. So treatments, procedures and diseases that you'll see in childhood.
And we're going to have a go at the game in a moment. But on each card, it has a word that you might need to describe, like asthma, and
yes,
you have to describe this word to the other people that are playing without using the word asthma, but also without using five other words that are on the card, which is quite tricky because it's got things like wheezing, which you think, oh, but that's just such an obvious asthma word, to not say it is really hard.
Yes, these are other jargon words that I thought that people might use in their explanation of let's say asthma. So the player really, really has to concentrate on using child-friendly language, and that allows them to just think about the language that they use in future.
And have you tested it out on doctors or other medical staff?
Yes. So far we've tested it on doctors, medical students, nurses and nursing students at Raigmore Hospital, where I'm based at the moment. And we've had some really positive feedback. They really enjoyed playing it. Some of them are getting quite competitive.
Clever. And I was thinking this might be quite useful for us, because we're always trying to get people we interview not to use jargon that listeners won't necessarily be familiar with. And kind of a game like this would be quite good, I think, to stop them doing it. Or maybe a buzzer that buzzes and interrupts them when they do that at the wrong moment. So this is particularly for doctors that are working with children. But I was wondering whether this could just apply more generally, because anyone might not know particular medical jargon that's used for particular parts of the body when there is an alternative for it.
Oh, exactly. And that's why we hope that this will be the first in a series, because you see this same problem throughout all the specialties of medicine and even areas outside of medicine.
What other sorts of things?
So we've had lawyers saying that there's a lot of jargon used in the legal system, dentistry, politics. There's a lot of jargon in modern day life.
So in an ideal world, would you like to sort of walk into a common room in a hospital, a staff common room, and see everyone there playing this game?
I hope so. Yes. We've had plenty of the staff saying that they'd like to use it on training days, during their induction as an icebreaker, even on the Christmas nights out.
Christmas nights out. Well, Graham, you're very lucky, because you don't have to wait till Christmas, because it's time for you to have a go at this game now. And you've brought along with you two third-year medical students, Katie and Nelly. Thank you very much for coming today and playing this game. So, Graham, you've got the first card, and
right.
Your task is going to be to describe this medical condition so that the others can guess without using any of those other words on the card. If you do use those words, then I have my trusty buzzer.
Okay.
And that's what
okay.
will happen.
Okay.
And so, Katie and Nelly, your task is to try and guess what it is he's describing. Are you ready?
Yes.
Go.
Goodness. This is a problem where people don't want to eat much food. And they become quite ill, actually, sometimes, mm-hmm. and their weight goes down.
Anorexia.
And yes. Mm-hmm.
Very good, very
yeah.
good. Nelly.
Okay, so when you have this, you might find that your nose is a bit more runny.
Oh. Cold? No.
Not quite. And you have this a lot. You have this throughout the course of the year. And it's to do with
so it's
the
not hay fever.
No.
Rhinitis?
Yes.
Very good. Yeah. Allergic yeah. rhinitis. Very good. And Katie, your turn. Are you ready? Go.
Okay. This is a condition which lasts a very long time and involves your body's defences against disease being compromised?
I'm afraid there you said compromise. Now, it's not a word on a card, but is it a word a child would understand? Might not.
That's true.
Now, did you guess it? Have you guessed it yet?
I thought it was HIV, but
it's AIDS. Mm.
So how did you find doing that? Was that difficult?
Yeah, I think it's the way your words flow, you just naturally just fall into, this is how I learnt it at medical school. This is what was in the textbooks. This is what I know.
Yeah, hard to figure out your host defence system to kind of get around the immune system word.
Yeah, because you said defences mm-hmm. are down instead. Yeah, Graham, what do you think?
Well, I think what Victoria's done really well with this game is the list of words that you can't mm-hmm. use, because you suddenly realise, don't you, that we just naturally use those words, and you find yourself thinking, would someone understand who was a little mm-hmm. child? Even what we would consider fairly simple words. Yeah. So I think it's a fantastic game. I'm going to, if I can, I'm going to use it. Do I have to ask Victoria if I can use it in teaching?
You can download it from the website. You can buy the game, but you can also download the cards
Brilliant.
For free from the website. And yeah. we've put a link to it on the Health Check website, so you can see that.
I think it'd be great.
Well, thank you very much to Nelly and Katie for being very sporting and taking part in that. And Graham, do stay with us, because I want to come back to you. Now, in many places, mindfulness is the latest trend, with millions downloading apps and thousands going to classes. Drawing on Eastern meditation traditions, the idea is to increase your awareness of the present moment, to focus your mind and to observe your thoughts, positive or negative, coming and going. Now, many businesses and schools have also been embracing the technique. And now in Kenya, the prison system is introducing mindfulness, as Maeve Francis reports from the capital.
It's mid-morning at Lingata Maximum Security Women's Prison in Nairobi.
in a large recreation room above the prison library. Around 60 women prisoners are gathering.
I am Sheila, I am happy.
Each woman checks in, standing up, and declares how she is feeling today. It's a real mixed bag.
I'm hungry. Is she hungry, annoyed, or hungry stomach?
The women are gathered here today to learn about mindfulness, a technique to help build their awareness of the present moment, acknowledging the feelings, thoughts, and bodily sensations within it. At the front of the room is their instructor, Inma, who is a psychologist based in Britain at the business school at Exeter University. Inma has been working in Kenyan prisons for 2 years. At first, she just worked with guards and welfare officers, teaching them mindfulness and authentic leadership.
And then they said, well, we just want more. And we want more mindfulness. And then they were talking about the huge benefits that I was having on them. So then from there, it just grew and grew.
What we are going to do to start with is to connect with our bodies, our wonderful bodies. Aren't they wonderful?
Yes. Yes.
So what we are going to do first is we will breathe in, and when we are breathing in...
The women then turn to their neighbour and tell them what they like about themselves.
What I like about myself is being patient.
Then they get down to learning about specific mindfulness techniques. They start with the radio technique, listening to their inner voices.
We are not going to try to control anything. We are just going to be aware. What is our radio telling us right now at this point? And in that radio, we may have different channels at the same time, don't we?
Yes.
We may have one channel that is really loud. We may have music sometimes, but other times don't we have negative news?
The negative channel is about our families being away from us. Basically, that's allowing us to connect with what is in our inner radio, our head, because sometimes we are not even aware of what our thoughts and emotions are. But then we come to what I call mindfulness plus, because the plus is about rewiring your brain. So then in this context, and the radio plus means that you are not just the audience who is aware, but you become the manager.
It's a technique that seems to be working for one of the prisoners, Anne.
Actually, what happens after we met her and she has told us about the radiotherapy, you are with us. So you have to switch from one station to another. You are thinking about the positive and the negative.
Anne just turned 40. She's been in prison for 7 years for drug trafficking. She says that thinking positively helps her believe that, like many other prisoners, her sentence may get commuted.
I'm serving a life sentence. That is a negative one. But if I'm thinking positively, there's life after this, because there are people who have been here serving a life sentence and they have, none of them has died here and they have gone. So it's all about being positive. So you start thinking, okay, fine, I'm here. I don't know how long I'm going to be here, but you're living a day at a time and doing something good each day.
The prisoners aren't the only ones practicing mindfulness. Olivia Obel is the director of Langata Women's Prison. The prison holds around 600 inmates, or clients, as Olivia refers to them.
Yes, I do practice mindfulness myself. It's quite wholesome. It's really getting to know who you really are.
Olivia met Inma on a training trip to Britain.
We were exposed to the practices within the corrections systems in the UK. She was one of the professional or experts who we met during our exposure to those jurisdictions out there. And we thought that there are certain programs that we could borrow and come and practice here, which are very useful. We don't need really so much resources to put them in place. And that's how Inma has been coming.
Hi!
Prisons are a reflection of the society. So there's no difference, really. How are we taking care of those people out in society? What is our culture? How do we interact with people?
Olivia was shocked when she was visiting Britain, where she met Inma, and learned of the high rate of suicide among British prisoners.
I was kind of traumatized, to say the least, when I realized that the prison guards are issued some kind of pliers as a tool so they can clip, you know, when the rope, when that suicide takes place, which I went to show that really that, I think, must be very prevalent.
Back in class, the women have split up and formed groups. They are practicing teaching the mindfulness to other prisoners. Langata is a large prison, so it makes sense for the women to spread the learning around.
And then in these groups, they are going to create materials, put stories, put
what is relevant for them and explain it with their words, so that later on they can train each other, and then this handbook is going to be going to all institutions.
Inma doesn't believe that the classes will be a quick fix or a band-aid.
We are interested in mindfulness really, really making a difference. And for that to really happen, mindfulness needs to be embodied into a sense of self. So then the work that I'm doing here is about teaching these techniques, but also creating a sense of identity in which mindfulness is core to that identity.
Over the next few months, Inma will study the impacts of these programs at Langata Women's and also at other prisons she works at in Kenya.
So we have a long list of indicators to what extent now they're consuming less drugs, less alcohol, to what extent they respect now the institution, the rules, regulations, they engage less with conflict, they have a better health, all of those sorts of things.
In a few months, Inma will be checking back in with the inmates to see if mindfulness is improving their lives. In the meantime, she hopes that the women will continue working on their practice and teaching it to other women who could benefit.
Mae Francis in Nairobi. This is Health Check from the BBC. I'm Claudia Hammond, and my guest, Dr. Graham Easton, is still with us. Now, Graham, there's new research out this week that caught my eye about heart attacks being the leading cause of death among on-duty firefighters. And now researchers at Edinburgh University think they might have worked out why. Why could it be?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because you'd think firefighters, yes, injuries, yes, burns, emotional stress, all sorts of problems and challenges. But heart attacks, why would that be? Well, they, in essence, they've done some very interesting research which seems to show that it's mainly about the way that heat affects the blood thickening and becoming much more liable to clot. Even when they're in exercise situations, putting out fires for practice, their body temperature can go up by as much as 1 degree C and stay there for 3 or 4 hours. And this heat, along with the dehydration caused by sweating and so on, can actually mean that the blood starts to become more concentrated, more liable to clot.
So it seems hard to know what you could do about that, because they can't not put out fires and they are already wearing protective clothing. So it's not as if they're not getting burnt. So
exactly. So, yes, it's the fluid loss through the sweating. It's some sort of inflammatory response to the heat, making it more concentrated in the blood. And there's some minor injury to heart muscle that they've measured as well in blood tests. What they're saying is that simple measures like trying to stay hydrated, drinking plenty of fluid, taking time to cool off, so breaks, if they're allowed it. And the trouble with for firefighters doing this amazingly brave job is that often they'll go in, out again, and they often don't have teams to replace them, not enough teams to back them up. But if they could, that would be fantastic.
And then there's some other news on heart attacks this week. A new blood test which can work out whether or not people have actually had a heart attack if it's suspected. How do you usually work it out? I mean, someone ends up in hospital, how do you know?
Yes, this is work from scientists at King's College, and normally what we do in an emergency department would be to do an ECG, a heart tracing, listen to someone's story, and that gets us part of the way there usually. But normally we rely very heavily on a blood test, which is a measure of a protein that's created in the bloodstream when there's damage to the heart muscle. Now, if there's absolutely none of that protein in the blood, we can be pretty sure, send someone home, you haven't had a heart attack. But very many people, perhaps as much as 50% of people with chest pain, have a slightly raised this protein called troponin in the blood. And that is a real problem. So this new test, which is a slightly different protein, seems to be much more sensitive at the moment. So I'm picking up much more of those sort of marginal cases.
And would this be easy to use? Could this be used everywhere?
Well, so at the moment, they've just tested this on donor heart muscle. So they need to be tested on real patients in the emergency situation, and probably in much bigger numbers as well before we know whether it's effective.
Thanks, Graham. Now, last week, 13 countries in West and Central Africa took part in synchronised polio campaigns, vaccinating more than 116 million children. Vaccination drives like this mean that polio is only endemic now in three remaining countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan and Nigeria. But occasionally, wild poliovirus can spread back to previously polio-free areas, so monitoring remains crucial. Now, in most countries, surveillance is done by spotting cases of paralysis. But a team in Israel is keeping tabs on polio before people develop symptoms by sniffing it out in sewage. And they've just published their latest findings. So I asked Yakir Bachenko, Professor of Industrial Engineering at Ben Gurion University, how they do it.
Basically, you can use a sewage or a sewage sample like doctor uses a stool sample from an individual. So using the stool sample from the entire population, you can find the virus before anyone gets sick with the disease. And the thing is that polio is a fecal-oral disease, and once you have it in your guts, in your system, you shed it out, and eventually it goes down the drain. And you can find virus particles in the sewage without even you showing the symptoms. And this is an alternative method to the previous one, and much superior to it on many reasons. First of all, you don't have to wait for someone to get paralyzed. Second of all, you can cover an entire city with one stroke without going to, you know, each and every individual. And additionally, the sensitivity of this method is much, much better. So one of the reasons this method wasn't adopted and recommended by the WHO is that, you know, like any other big system, the WHO has to be conservative and move slowly and cannot recommend new methods. Another reason being is that the sensitivity of this method, this so-called environmental surveillance method, the sensitivity of it was not known. And, you know, researchers really didn't know if it's any good right until now. And in our research, we were able to calibrate this method and show, you know, several wonderful quantitative things with this method and show that typically, for example, it's more sensitive than the alternative method by a factor of you know, 1,000.
How easy would it be to use this method in other parts of the world? I mean, what about somewhere where people are living in slum conditions where they haven't got adequate sanitation? Would there still be a way of doing this?
The short answer is yes. Obviously, when there's no sewage system or nothing at all and people use their own private septic tanks, this monitoring system would be inappropriate. But in many other countries, even Pakistan or India or parts of Africa where we do have some sort of river systems or canal or even sewage running down the streets and reaching eventually some sort of reservoir, you can sample this reservoir and check for the presence of virus particles. You don't need to have a sewer well-maintained like we have in the Western world.
And in an ideal world, how regularly would you need to test these samples and would you need to do them in small, different geographical areas and have something very comprehensive to be able to be sure whether you had any new cases or not?
So that depends on several variables. And up until now, there was no answer. No one could provide an answer for this question. For example, how frequently should I sample my sewage? Or if I do sample the sewage and I don't find any virus particles, is it because the population is clean and polio-free, or is it just due to bad luck and I didn't sample, you know, the right part of the reservoir? And now, after we calibrated the model using pretty simple, well, not extremely simple, but not very sophisticated statistical tools, we can actually answer these kind of questions. And we can answer people or in policymakers who ask us, how often should I sample this and this reservoir? Or if I do sample and I don't find anything, should I be reassured? Or how much do I need to sample in order to be reassured at a certain level?
And if this method was used widely, would it be likely to make a difference in the countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan that still have poliovirus? Or is it more about making sure there aren't recurrences in countries where we think that it's no longer there?
Why not both, actually? So yes, in Israel, for example, we used it, or it could have been used, in order to, at the first phase, to estimate how many people you have with the virus in the population. This is another interesting question. Whether you have a small outbreak or a large outbreak, it can make a difference. And once you do have an outbreak and the policymaker and the authorities reacted in some manner, after a while, if you don't find any more polio cases, have you eradicated it and is the population clean now and polio-free? So this is one thing. A second thing that our method can help with. And a third thing our method can help with is, like you said, monitoring and keeping an eye out whether the polio is reaching elsewhere or polio-free countries.
Yakir Bachenko and his research is published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Now, Graham, before we go, a curious study from Warwick Business School, which has found that a certain kind of antidepressant might be able to help people with obesity to choose healthy foods instead of fatty ones. really? Houses work?
This is fascinating research. Obviously a big issue because obesity has more than doubled worldwide since 1980. Essentially, in a series of trials, the researchers found that people who took the antidepressant called citalopram, which is from the family from like Prozac, and boosts levels of the happy hormone serotonin in the brain, seems to affect the way they choose food. They were given screens and they were given pictures of lovely, lovely but unhealthy food like chocolates and pastries and things, and also pictures of rather healthier food like apples and vegetables. And they were asked to choose between these things, having already rated them whether they're healthy or not beforehand. And so when they do that after the citalopram, compared to when they do it after placebo and another type of medication, they seem to be choosing the healthy foods much more often. It's as if they start to choose to focus on the long-term health gains rather than the short-term, this is going to be lovely, which is what, you know, all of us tend to struggle with that battle with weight and obesity.
So if this was going to work as a way of people choosing healthier foods in the long term, then there are hundreds and thousands of people who've taken Prozac over the years, so we should expect those people to have lost weight and started eating healthy foods.
Yeah, but there's a couple of problems in my head. One, that this is a very small study, it's only about 27 patients. The second is that they gave a one-off dose. And normally, of course, it takes several weeks for the clinical effects, certainly to do with mood, to kick in with a drug like citalopram. And then, as you say, we know that one of the recognised side effects for some people on citalopram are weight changes, sometimes weight loss, but often weight gain. That's something I've experienced myself on that drug. I'm finding it slightly tricky to work out long-term whether this is going to make a big impact, but it's something that we've got to look into more with more people, do more research on it.
Interesting study. Thanks very much, Graham Easton, for joining us today. That's all for today's Health Check from the BBC, but we'll be back at the same time next week when I'll be reporting from Vietnam on the dangers of eating raw pig's blood. Melanie Brown was the producer today. If you have any thoughts, I'm on Twitter at Claudia Hammond. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, do download our sister programme, Science in Action, for the latest science news.